This is Audible.
Cadman presents Welcome to the Monkey House, a collection of short works by Kurt Vonnegut. Read by Bill Irwin, Maria Tucci, Dylan Baker, David Strathairn, and Tony Roberts.
Where I Live. Read by Bill Irwin. Not very long ago, an encyclopedia salesman stopped by America's oldest library building, which is the lovely Sturgis Library in Barnstable Village on Cape Cod's North Shore, and he pointed out to the easily alarmed librarian that the library's most recent general reference work was a 1938 Britannica, backstopped by a 1910 Americana. He said many important things had happened since 1938, naming among others penicillin and Hitler's invasion of Poland. He was advised to take his astonishment to some of the library's directors. He was given their names and addresses. There was a Cabot on the list, and a Lowell, and a Kittredge, and some others. The librarian told him that he had a chance of catching several directors all at once if he would go to the Barnstable Yacht Club. So he went down the narrow Yacht Club road, nearly broke his neck as he hit a series of terrific bumps put in the road to discourage speeders, to kill them if possible. He wanted a martini, wondered if a non-member could get service at the bar. He was appalled to discover that the club was nothing but a shack 14 feet wide and 30 feet long, a touch of the Ozarks in Massachusetts. It contained an hilariously warped ping-pong table, a wire lost-and-found basket with sandy, fragrant contents, and an upright piano that had been under a leak in the roof for years. There wasn't any bar, any telephone, any electricity. There weren't any members there, either. To cap it all, there wasn't a drop of water in the harbor. The tide, which can be as great as 14 feet, was utterly out, and the so-called yachts, antique wooden Rhodes 18s, Beetle Cats, and a couple of Boston Whalers, were resting on the bluish-brown glurp of the emptied harbor's floor. Clouds of gulls and terns were yelling about all that glurp, and about all the good things in it they were finding to eat. A few men were out there, too, digging clams as fat as partridges from the rim of Sandy Neck, the 10-mile-long sand finger that separates the harbor from the ice-cold bay. And ducks and geese and herons and other waterfowl were out there, too, teemingly, in the great salt marsh that bounds the harbor on the west. And, near the harbor's narrow mouth, a yawl from Marblehead, with a 6-foot keel, lay on her side, waiting for the water to come back in again. She should never have come into Barnstable Village, not with a keel like that. The salesman, very depressed, insensitive to the barbarous beauty all around him, went to lunch. Since he was in the seat of the most booming county in New England, Barnstable County, and since the boom was a tourist boom, he had reason to expect something mildly voluptuous in the way of a place to eat. What he had to settle for, though, was a chromium stool at a formica counter in an aggressively uncute, uncolonial institution called the Barnstable News Store. Another Ozarks touch. An Ozarks department store. The motto of the place: if it's any good, we've got it. If it's no good, we've sold it. After lunch, he went trustee hunting again, and was told to try the village museum, which is in the old brick customs house. The building itself is a memorial to long-gone days when the harbor was used by fair-sized ships, before it filled up with all that bluish-brown glurp. There was no trustee there, and the exhibits were excruciatingly boring. The salesman found himself strangling on apathy, an affliction epidemic among casual visitors to Barnstable Village. He took the customary cure, which is to jump into his car and roar off toward the cocktail lounges, motor courts, bowling alleys, gift shops, and pizzerias of Hyannis, the commercial heart of Cape Cod. He there worked off his frustrations on a miniature golf course called Playland. At that time, that particular course had a pathetic, maddening feature typical of the random butchery of the Cape's south shore. The course was built on the lawn of what had once been an American Legion post, and right in the middle of the cunning little bridges and granulated cork fairways was a Sherman tank. set there in simpler and less enterprising days as a memorial to the veterans of World War II. The memorial has since been moved, but it is still on the south side, where it is bound to be engulfed by indignities again. The dignity of the tank would be a lot safer in Barnstable Village, but the village would never accept it. It has a policy of never accepting anything. As a happy consequence, it changes about as fast as the rules of chess. The biggest change in recent years has taken place at the polls. Until 6 years ago, the Democratic poll watchers and the Republican poll watchers were all Republicans. Now the Democratic poll watchers are Democrats. The consequences of this revolution have not been nearly as awful as expected so far. Another break with the past has to do with the treasury of the local amateur theatrical society, the Barnstable Comedy Club. The club had a treasurer who, once a month for 30 years, angrily refused to say what the balance was for fear that the club would spend it foolishly. He resigned last year. The new treasurer announced a balance of $400 and some odd cents, and the membership blew it all on a new curtain the color of spoiled salmon. This ptomaine curtain, incidentally, made its debut during a production of the Caine Mutiny Court-Martial, in which Captain Queeg did not nervously rattle steel balls in his hand. The balls were eliminated on the theory that they were suggestive. Another big change took place about 60 years ago, when it was discovered that tuna were good to eat. Barnstable fishermen used to call them horse mackerel, and curse whenever they caught one. Still cursing, they would chop it up and throw it back into the bay as a warning to other horse mackerel. Out of courage or plain stupidity, the tuna did not go away, and now make possible a post-Labor Day festival called the Barnstable Tuna Derby. Sportsmen with reels as big as courthouse clocks come from all over the eastern seaboard for the event. The villagers are always mystified as to what brought them, and nobody ever catches anything. Another discovery that still lies in the future for the villagers to make and to learn to live with is that mussels can be eaten without causing instant death. Barnstable Harbor is in places clogged with them. They are never disturbed. One reason for their being ignored, perhaps, is that the harbor abounds in two other delicacies far simpler to prepare, striped bass and clams. To get clams, one can scratch almost anywhere when the tide is out. To get bass, one follows the birds, looks for cone-shaped formations of them, casts his lure to the place where the cone points. Bass will be feeding there. As for what else the future holds, few Cape Cod villages have much chance of coming through the present greedy, tasteless boom with their souls intact. H.L. Mencken once said something to the effect that nobody ever went broke overestimating the vulgarity of the American people. And fortunes now being made out of the vulgarization of the Cape surely bear this out. The soul of Barnstable Village just might survive. For one thing, it is not a hollow village, with everything for rent, with half of the houses empty in the winter. Most of the people live there all year round, and most of them aren't old, and most of them work as carpenters, salesmen, masons, architects, teachers, writers, and what have you. It is a classless society, a sometimes affectionate and sentimental one. And these full houses, often riddled by termites and dry rot, but good probably for a few hundred years more, have been built chock-a-block along Main Street since the end of the Civil War. Developers find very little room in which to work their pious depredations. There is a seeming vast green meadow to the west, but this is salt marsh, the bluish-brown glurp capped by a mat of salt hay. It was this natural hay, by the way, that tempted settlers down from Plymouth in 1639. The marsh, laced by deep creeks that can be explored by small boats, can never be built upon by anyone sane. It goes underwater at every moontide, and is capable of supporting a man and his dog and not much more. Speculators and developers got very excited for a while about the possibility of improving Sandy Neck, the long, slender barrier of spectacular dunes that bounds the harbor on the north. There are grotesque forests of dead trees out there, trees suffocated by sand, then unburied again. And the outer beach, for all practical purposes infinite, puts the beach of Acapulco to shame. Surprisingly, too, fresh water can be had out there from quite shallow wells, but the local government, thank God, is buying up all of Sandy Neck but the tip at the harbor mouth and is making it a public park to be kept unimproved forever. There is a tiny settlement on the tip of the neck, the tip that the government is not taking over. It is clustered around the abandoned lighthouse, a lighthouse that was once needed when there was enough water around to let big ships come and go. The bleached and tacky settlement can be reached only by boat or beach buggy. There is no electricity there, no telephone. It is a private resort. Less than a mile from Barnstable Village, the tip of the neck is where many villagers go when they need a vacation. And all of the anachronistic, mildly xenophobic, charming queernesses of Barnstable Village might entitle it to the epithet Last Stronghold of the True Cape Codders, if it weren't for one thing. Hardly anyone in the village was born on Cape Cod. Just as petrified wood is formed by minerals slowly replacing organic materials, so has the present-day petrified Barnstable been formed by persons from Evanston and Louisville and Boston and Pittsburgh and God only knows where else, slowly replacing authentic rural Yankees. If the real Cape Codders could rise from their churchyard graves, cast aside their beautifully lettered slate headstones and attend a meeting of the Barnstable Village Civic Association, they would approve of the proceedings. Every proposal that has ever come before the organization has been hotly debated and voted down, except that a new siren be bought for the rescue truck. The siren goes bweep, 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 bweep instead of rawr, and is guaranteed to be audible at a distance of 3 miles. The library, incidentally, now has a new Britannica and a new Americana, too, purchases it made effortlessly since it has money coming out of its ears. But so far, the school marks of the children and the conversation of the adults have not conspicuously improved. Since the village exists for itself and not for passers-by, and since it specializes in hastening tourists on to paradises elsewhere, visitors play hell finding anything to like about it. For a quick sample of how good it can be, a visitor might stop off at St. Mary's Church on Main Street, which has, unadvertised anywhere, the most enchanting church garden in America. The garden is the work of one man, Robert Nicholson, an Episcopalian minister, a good man who died young. At a village cocktail party one time, and the villagers do drink a lot, Father Nicholson was talking to a Roman Catholic and a Jew, trying to find a word to describe the underlying spiritual unity of Barnstable. He found one. "We're druids," he said.
Harrison Bergeron, read by Maria Tucci. The year was 2081, and everybody was finally equal. They weren't only equal before God and the law. They were equal every which way. Nobody was smarter than anybody else. Nobody was better looking than anybody else. Nobody was stronger or quicker than anybody else. All this equality was due to the 211th, 212th, and 213th Amendments to the Constitution, and to the unceasing vigilance of agents of the United States Handicapper General. Some things about living still weren't quite right, though. April, for instance, still drove people crazy by not being springtime. And it was in that clammy month that the HG men took George and Hazel Bergeron's 14-year-old son Harrison away. It was tragic, all right, but George and Hazel couldn't think about it very hard. Hazel had a perfectly average intelligence, which meant she couldn't think about anything except in short bursts. And George, while his intelligence was way above normal, had a little mental handicap radio in his ear. He was required by law to wear it at all times. It was tuned to a government transmitter. Every 20 seconds or so, the transmitter would send out some sharp noise to keep people like George from taking unfair advantage of their brains. George and Hazel were watching television. There were tears on Hazel's cheeks, but she'd forgotten for the moment what they were about. On the television screen were ballerinas. A buzzer sounded in George's head. His thoughts fled in panic, like bandits from a burglar alarm. "That was a real pretty dance, that dance they just did," said Hazel. "Huh?" said George. "That dance. It was nice," said Hazel. "Yep," said George. He tried to think a little about the ballerinas. They weren't really very good, no better than anybody else would have been anyway. They were burdened with sash weights and bags of birdshot, and their faces were masked so that no one, seeing a free and graceful gesture or a pretty face, would feel like something the cat drug in. George was toying with a vague notion that maybe dancers shouldn't be handicapped. But he didn't get very far with it before another noise in his ear radio scattered his thoughts. George winced. So did two out of the eight ballerinas. Hazel saw him wince. Having no mental handicap herself, she had to ask George what the latest sound had been. "Sounded like somebody hitting a milk bottle with a ball peen hammer," said George. "I think it would be real interesting hearing all the different sounds," said Hazel, a little envious. "All the things they think up." "Mm," said George. "Only if I was handicapper general, you know what I would do?" said Hazel. Hazel, as a matter of fact, bore a strong resemblance to the handicapper general, a woman named Diana Moon Glampers. "If I was Diana Moon Glampers," said Hazel, "I'd have chimes on Sunday. Just chimes. Kind of in honor of religion."
"I could think if it was just chimes," said George.
"Well, maybe make him real loud," said Hazel. "I think I'd make a good handicapper general."
"Good as anybody else," said George.
"Who knows better than I do what normal is," said Hazel.
"Right," said George.
He began to think glimmeringly about his abnormal son who was now in jail, about Harrison. But a 21-gun salute in his head stopped that.
"Boy," said Hazel, "that was a doozy, wasn't it?"
It was such a doozy that George was white and trembling, and tears stood on the rims of his red eyes. Two of the eight ballerinas had collapsed to the studio floor and were holding their temples.
"All of a sudden you look so tired," said Hazel. "Why don't you stretch out on the sofa so you can rest your handicap bag on the pillows, honey bunch?"
She was referring to the 47 pounds of birdshot in a canvas bag, which was padlocked around George's neck.
"Go on and rest the bag for a little while," she said. "I don't care if you're not equal to me for a while."
George weighed the bag with his hands.
"I don't mind it," he said. "I don't notice it anymore. It's just a part of me."
"You've been so tired lately. Kind of wore out," said Hazel. "If there was just some way we could make a little hole in the bottom of the bag and just take out a few of them lead balls. Just a few."
"2 years in prison and $2,000 fine for every ball I took out," said George. "I don't call that a bargain."
"If you could just take a few out when you came home from work," said Hazel. "I mean, you don't compete with anybody around here. You just sit around."
"If I tried to get away with it," said George, "then other people would get away with it, and pretty soon we'd be right back to the Dark Ages again with everybody competing against everybody else. You wouldn't like that, would you?"
"I'd hate it," said Hazel.
"There you are," said George. "The minute people start cheating on laws, what do you think happens to society?"
If Hazel hadn't been able to come up with an answer to this question, George couldn't have supplied one. A siren was going off in his head.
"Reckon it'd fall all apart," said Hazel.
"What would?" said George blankly.
"Society," said Hazel uncertainly. "Wasn't that what you just said?"
"Who knows," said George.
The television program was suddenly interrupted for a news bulletin. It wasn't clear at first as to what the bulletin was about, since the announcer, like all announcers, had a serious speech impediment. For about half a minute, and in a state of high excitement, the announcer tried to say "ladies and gentlemen." But he finally gave up, handed the bulletin to a ballerina to read.
"Oh, that's all right," Hazel said of the announcer. "He tried. That's the big thing. He tried to do the best he could with what God gave him. He should get a nice raise for trying so hard." "Ladies and gentlemen," said the ballerina, reading the bulletin.
She must have been extraordinarily beautiful, because the mask she wore was hideous.
and it was easy to see that she was the strongest and the most graceful of all the dancers, for her handicap bags were as big as those worn by 200-pound men. And she had to apologize at once for her voice, which was a very unfair voice for a woman to use. Her voice was a warm, luminous, timeless melody. "Excuse me," she said, and she began again, making her voice absolutely uncompetitive. "Harrison Bergeron, age 14, she said in a grackle squawk, "has just escaped from jail, where he was held on suspicion of plotting to overthrow the government. He is a genius and an athlete, is underhandicapped, and should be regarded as extremely dangerous." A police photograph of Harrison Bergeron was flashed on the screen. Upside down, then sideways, upside down again, then right side up. The picture showed the full length of Harrison Bergeron against a background calibrated in feet and inches. He was exactly 7 feet tall. The rest of Harrison's appearance was Halloween and hardware. Nobody had ever borne heavier handicaps. He had outgrown hindrances faster than the HG men could think them up. Instead of a little ear radio for a mental handicap, he wore a tremendous pair of earphones and spectacles with thick, wavy lenses. The spectacles were intended to make him not only half-blind, but to give him whanging headaches besides. Scrap metal was hung all over him. Ordinarily, there was a certain symmetry, a military neatness to the handicaps issued to strong people. But Harrison looked like a walking junkyard. In the race of life, Harrison carried 300 pounds. And to offset his good looks, the HG men required that he wear at all times a red rubber ball for a nose, keep his eyebrows shaved off, and cover his even white teeth with black caps at snaggletooth random. "If you see this boy," said the ballerina, "do not, I repeat, do not try to reason with him." There was the shriek of a door being torn from its hinges. Screams and barking cries of consternation came from the television set. The photograph of Harrison Bergeron on the screen jumped again and again as though dancing to the tune of an earthquake. George Bergeron correctly identified the earthquake, and well he might have, for many was the time his own home had danced to the same crashing tune. "My God," said George, "that must be Harrison." The realization was blasted from his mind instantly by the sound of an automobile collision in his head. When George could open his eyes again, the photograph of Harrison was gone. A living, breathing Harrison filled the screen. Clanking, clownish, and huge, Harrison stood in the center of the studio. The knob of the uprooted studio door was still in his hand. Ballerinas, technicians, musicians, and announcers cowered on their knees before him, expecting to die. "I am the Emperor," cried Harrison. "Do you hear? I am the Emperor. Everybody must do what I say at once." He stamped his foot, and the studio shook. "Even as I stand here," he bellowed, "crippled, hobbled, sickened, I'm a greater ruler than any man who ever lived. Now watch me become what I can become." Harrison tore the straps of his handicap harness like wet tissue paper, tore straps guaranteed to support 5,000 pounds. Harrison's scrap iron handicaps crashed to the floor. Harrison thrust his thumbs under the bar of the padlock that secured his head harness. The bar snapped like celery. Harrison smashed his headphones and spectacles against the wall. He flung away his rubber ball nose, revealed a man that would have awed Thor, the god of thunder. "I shall now select my empress," he said, looking down on the cowering people. "Let the first woman who dares rise to her feet claim her mate and her throne." A moment passed, and then a ballerina arose, swaying like a willow. Harrison plucked the mental handicap from her ear, snapped off her physical handicaps with marvelous delicacy, and last of all, he removed her mask. She was blindingly beautiful. "Now," said Harrison, taking her hand, "shall we show the people the meaning of the word dance?" "Music," he commanded. The musicians scrambled back into their chairs, and Harrison stripped them of their handicaps, too. "Play your best," he told them,
and I'll make you barons and dukes and earls." The music began. It was normal at first, cheap, silly, false. But Harrison snatched two musicians from their chairs, waved them like batons as he sang the music as he wanted it played. He slammed them back into their chairs. The music began again and was much improved. Harrison and his empress merely listened to the music for a while, listened gravely, as though synchronizing their heartbeats with it. They shifted their weights to their toes. Harrison placed his big hands on the girl's tiny waist, letting her sense the weightlessness that would soon be hers. And then, in an explosion of joy and grace, into the air they sprang. Not only were the laws of the land abandoned, but the law of gravity and the laws of motion as well. They reeled, whirled, swiveled, flounced, capered, gambled, and spun. They leaped like deer on the moon. The studio ceiling was 30 feet high, but each leap brought the dancers nearer to it. It became their obvious intention to kiss the ceiling. They kissed it. And then, neutralizing gravity with love and pure will, they remained suspended in air, inches below the ceiling, and they kissed each other for a long, long time. It was then that Diana Moon Glampers, the handicapper general, came into the studio with a double-barreled 10-gauge shotgun. She fired twice, and the Emperor and the Empress were dead before they hit the floor. Diana Moon Glampers loaded the gun again. She aimed it at the musicians and told them they had 10 seconds to get their handicaps back on. It was then that the Bergeron's television tube burned out. Hazel turned to comment about the blackout to George, but George had gone out into the kitchen for a can of beer. George came back in with a beer, paused while the handicap signal shook him up, and then he sat down again. "You've been crying," he said to Hazel.
"Yup," she said.
"What about?" he said.
"I forget," she said. "Something real sad on television."
"What was it?" he said.
"It's all kind of mixed up in my mind," said Hazel.
"Forget sad things," said George.
"I always do," said Hazel.
"That's my girl," said George. He winced. There was the sound of a riveting gun in his head.
"Gee, I could tell that one was a doozy," said Hazel.
"You can say that again," said George.
"Gee," said Hazel, "I could tell that one was a doozy."
Who Am I This Time? Read by Dylan Baker. The North Crawford Mask and Wig Club, an amateur theatrical society I belong to, voted to do Tennessee Williams' A Streetcar Named Desire for the spring play. Doris Sawyer, who always directs, said she couldn't direct this time because her mother was so sick. And she said the club ought to develop some other directors anyway, because she couldn't live forever, even though she'd made it safely to 74. So I got stuck with the directing job, even though the only thing I'd ever directed before was the installation of combination aluminum storm windows and screens I'd sold. That's what I am, a salesman of storm windows and doors, and here and there a bathtub enclosure. As far as acting goes, the highest rank I ever held on stage was either butler or policeman, whichever's higher. I made a lot of conditions before I took the directing job, and the biggest one was that Harry Nash, the only real actor the club has, had to take the Marlon Brando part in the play. To give you an idea of how versatile Harry is, inside of 1 year, he was Captain Queeg in the Kane Mutiny Court-Martial, then Abe Lincoln in Abe Lincoln in Illinois, and then the young architect in The Moon is Blue. The year after that, Harry Nash was Henry VIII in Anne of the Thousand Days, and Doc in Come Back, Little Sheba, and I was after him for Marlon Brando in A Streetcar Named Desire. Harry wasn't at the meeting to say whether he'd take the part or not. He never came to meetings. He was too shy. He didn't stay away from meetings because he had something else to do. He wasn't married, didn't go out with women, didn't have any close men friends either. He stayed away from all kinds of gatherings because he never could think of anything to say or do without a script. So I had to go down to Miller's hardware store, where Harry was a clerk, the next day, and ask him if he'd take the part. I stopped off at the telephone company to complain about a bill I'd gotten for a call to Honolulu. I'd never called Honolulu in my life. And there was this beautiful girl I'd never seen before behind the counter at the phone company. And she explained that the company had put in an automatic billing machine and that the machine didn't have all the bugs out of it yet. It made mistakes. Not only did I not call Honolulu, I told her, I don't think anybody in North Crawford ever has or will. So she took the charge off the bill, and I asked her if she was from around North Crawford. She said no. She said she just came with the new billing machine to teach local girls how to take care of it. After that, she said she would go with some other machine to someplace else. Well, I said, as long as people have to come along with the machines, I guess we're all right.
What?
She said. When machines start delivering themselves, I said, I guess that's when the people better start really worrying.
Oh,
she said. She didn't seem very interested in that subject, and I wondered if she was interested in anything. She seemed kind of numb, almost a machine herself. An automatic phone company politeness machine. How long will you be in town here? I asked her.
I stay in each town 8 weeks, sir, she said. She had pretty blue eyes, but there sure wasn't much hope or curiosity in them.
She told me she had been going from town to town like that for 2 years, always a stranger. And I got it in my head that she might make a good Stella for the play. Stella was the wife of the Marlon Brando character, the wife of the character I wanted Harry Nash to play. She looked surprised, and she warmed up a little.
You know, she said, that's the first time anybody ever asked me to participate in any community thing.
Well, I said, there isn't any other way to get to know a lot of nice people faster than to be in a play with them. She said her name was Helene Shaw. She said she might just surprise me and herself. She said she just might come. You would think that North Crawford would be fed up with Harry Nash in plays after all the plays he'd been in. But the fact was that North Crawford probably could have gone on enjoying Harry forever, because he was never Harry on stage. When the maroon curtain went up on the stage in the gymnasium of the Consolidated Junior-Senior High School, Harry, body and soul, was exactly what the script and the director told him to be. Somebody said one time that Harry ought to go to a psychiatrist so he could be something important and colorful in real life, too. So he could get married anyway and maybe get a better job than just clerking in Miller's hardware store for $50 a week. But I don't know what a psychiatrist could have turned up about him that the town didn't already know. The trouble with Harry was he had been left on the doorstep of the Unitarian Church when he was a baby, and he never did find out who his parents were. When I told him there in Miller's that I'd been appointed director, that I wanted him in my play, he said what he always said to anybody who asked him to be in a play, and it was kind of sad, if you think about it.
Who am I this time? He said.
So I held the tryouts, where they are always held, in the meeting room on the second floor of the North Crawford Public Library. Dora Sawyer, the woman who usually directs, came to give me the benefit of all her experience. The two of us sat in state upstairs, while the people who wanted parts waited below. We called them upstairs one by one. Harry Nash came to the tryouts, even though it was a waste of time. I guess he wanted to get that little bit more acting in. For Harry's pleasure, and our pleasure too, we had him read from the scene where he beats up his wife. It was a play in itself, the way Harry did it, and Tennessee Williams hadn't written it all either. Tennessee Williams didn't write the part, for instance, where Harry, who weighs about 145, who's about 5 feet 8 inches tall, added 50 pounds to his weight and 4 inches to his height by just picking up a playbook. He had a short little double-breasted bellows-back grade school graduation suit coat on and a dinky little red tie with a horse head on it. He took off the coat and tie, opened his collar, then turned his back to Doris and me, getting up steam for the part. There was a great big rip in the back of his shirt, and it looked like a fairly new shirt, too. He had ripped it on purpose, so he could be that much more like Marlon Brando, right from the first. When he faced us again, he was huge and handsome and conceited and cruel. Doris read the part of Stella, the wife, and Harry bullied that old lady into believing that she was a sweet, pregnant girl married to a sexy gorilla who was going to beat her brains out. She had me believing it, too. And I read the lines of Blanche, her sister in the play, and darned if Harry didn't scare me into feeling like a drunk and faded Southern belle. And then, while Doris and I were getting over our emotional experiences, like people coming out from under ether, Harry put down the playbook, put on his coat and tie, and turned into the pale hardware store clerk again. Was that all right? He said, and he seemed pretty sure he wouldn't get the part. Well, I said, for a first reading, that wasn't too bad. Is there a chance I'll get the part? He said. I don't know why he always had to pretend there was some doubt about his getting a part, but he did. I think we can safely say we're leaning powerfully in your direction, I told him. He was very pleased. Thanks. Thanks a lot, he said, and he shook my hand. Is there a pretty new girl downstairs? I said, meaning Helene Shaw. I didn't notice, said Harry. It turned out that Helene Shaw had come for the tryouts, and Doris and I had our hearts broken. We thought the North Crawford Mask and Wig Club was finally going to put a really good-looking, really young girl on stage, instead of one of the beat-up 40-year-old women we generally have to palm off as girls. But Helene Shaw couldn't act for sour apples. No matter what we gave her to read, she was the same girl with the same smile for anybody who had a complaint about his phone bill. Doris tried to coach her some, to make her understand that Stella in the play was a very passionate girl who loved a gorilla because she needed a gorilla. But Helene just read the lines the same way again. I don't think a volcano could have stirred her up enough to say, ooh.
Dear, said Doris, I'm going to ask you a personal question.
All right, said Helene.
Have you ever been in love? Said Doris. The reason I ask, she said, remembering some old love might help you put more warmth in your acting.
Helene frowned and thought hard.
Well, she said, I travel a lot, you know, and practically all the men in the different companies I visit are married, and I never stay any place long enough to know many people who aren't.
What about school? Said Doris. What about puppy love and all the other kinds of love in school?
So Helene thought hard about that, and then she said,
even in school, I was always moving around a lot. My father was a construction worker, following jobs around. So I was always saying hello or goodbye to someplace, without anything in between.
Ah, said Doris.
Would movie stars count? Said Helene. I don't mean in real life. I never knew any. I just mean up on the screen.
Doris looked at me and rolled her eyes. I guess that's love of a kind, she said. And then Helene got a little enthusiastic.
I used to sit through movies over and over again, she said, and pretend I was married to whoever the man movie star was. They were the only people who came with us. No matter where we moved, movie stars were there.
Uh-huh, said Doris. Well, thank you, Miss Shaw, I said. You go downstairs and wait with the rest. We'll let you know. So we tried to find another Stella, and there just wasn't one. Not one woman in the club with the dew still on her. All we've got are Blanches, I said, meaning all we had were faded women who could play the part of Blanche, Stella's faded sister. That's life, I guess. 20 Blanches to one Stella.
And when you find a Stella, said Doris,
it turns out she doesn't know what love is. Doris and I decided there was one last thing we could try. We could get Harry Nash to play a scene along with Helene. He just might make her bubble the least little bit, I said. That girl hasn't got a bubble in her. So we called down the stairs for Helene to come back on up, and we told somebody to go find Harry. Harry never sat with the rest of the people at tryouts, or at rehearsals either. The minute he didn't have a part to play, he'd disappear into some hiding place, where he could hear people call him, but where he couldn't be seen. At tryouts in the library, he generally hid in the reference room, passing the time looking at flags of different countries in the front of the dictionary. Helene came back upstairs, and we were very sorry and surprised to see that she had been crying.
Oh, dear, said Doris. Oh, my. Now, what on earth's the trouble, dear? I was terrible, wasn't I? Said Helene, hanging her head.
Doris said the only thing anybody can say in an amateur theatrical society when somebody cries, she said,
Why, no, dear, you were marvelous. No, I wasn't, said Helene. I'm a walking icebox, and I know it.
Nobody could look at you and say that, said Doris.
When they get to know me, they can say it, said Helene. When people get to know me, that's what they do say.
Her tears got worse.
I don't want to be the way I am, she said. I just can't help it. Living the way I've lived all my life, the only experiences I've had have been in crazy dreams of movie stars. When I meet somebody nice in real life, I feel as though I were in some kind of big bottle, as though I couldn't touch that person, no matter how hard I tried.
And Helene pushed on air as though it were a big bottle all around her.
You ask me if I've ever been in love, she said to Doris. No, but I want to be. I know what this play's about. I know what Stella's supposed to feel and why she feels it. I...
she said, and her tears wouldn't let her go on.
You what, dear?
I,
said Helene, and she pushed on the imaginary bottle again.
I just don't know how to begin, she said.
There was heavy clumping on the library stairs. It sounded like a deep-sea diver coming upstairs in his lead shoes. It was Harry Nash turning himself into Marlon Brando. In he came, practically dragging his knuckles on the floor. And he was so much in character that the sight of a weeping woman made him sneer. "Harry," I said, "I'd like you to meet Helene Shaw. Helene, this is Harry Nash. If you get the part of Stella, he'll be your husband in the play." Harry didn't offer to shake hands. He put his hands in his pockets and he hunched over, and he looked her up and down, gave her looks that left her naked. Her tears stopped right then and there. "I wonder if you two would play the fight scene," I said, "and then the reunion scene right after it."
"Sure,"
said Harry, his eyes still on her. Those eyes burned up clothes faster than she could put them on.
"Sure,"
he said,
"if Stell's game."
"What?" said Helene. She'd turned the color of cranberry juice.
"Stell. Stella,"
said Harry.
"That's you. Stell's my wife."
I handed the two of them playbooks. Harry snatched his from me without a word of thanks. Helene's hands weren't working very well, and I had to kind of mold them around the book.
"I want something I can throw,"
said Harry. "What?" I said.
"There's one place where I throw a radio out a window,"
said Harry.
"What can I throw?"
So I said an iron paperweight was the radio, and I opened the window wide. Helene Shaw looked scared to death.
"Where you want us to start?"
said Harry, and he rolled his shoulders like a prize fighter warming up. "Start a few lines back from where you throw the radio out the window," I said.
"Okay. Okay,"
said Harry, warming up. Warming up. He scanned the stage directions.
"Let's see,"
he said.
"After I throw the radio, she runs off stage and I chase her and I sock her one."
"Right," I said.
"Okay, baby,"
Harry said to Helene, his eyelids drooping. What was about to happen was wilder than the chariot race in Ben-Hur.
"On your mark," said Harry. "Get ready, baby. Go."
When the scene was over, Helene Shaw was as hot as a hod carrier, as limp as an eel. She sat down with her mouth open and her head hanging to one side. She wasn't in any bottle anymore. There wasn't any bottle to hold her up and keep her safe and clean. The bottle was gone.
"Do I get the part or don't I?"
Harry snarled at me. "You'll do," I said.
"You said a mouthful," he said. "I'll be going now. See you around, Stella,"
he said to Helene, and he left. He slammed the door behind him. "Helene," I said. "Miss Shaw?"
"Hmm?"
she said. "The part of Stella is yours," I said. "You were great."
"I was," she said. "I had no idea you had that much fire in you, dear,"
Doris said to her.
"Fire?"
said Helene. She didn't know if she was afoot or on horseback.
"Skyrockets, pinwheels, Roman candles," said Doris. "Uh-huh,"
said Helene. And that was all she said. She looked as though she were going to sit in the chair with her mouth open forever. "Stella," I said.
"Huh?"
she said. "You have my permission to go." So we started having rehearsals four nights a week on the stage of the Consolidated School. And Harry and Helene set such a pace that everybody in the production was half crazy with excitement and exhaustion before we had rehearsed four times. Usually a director has to beg people to learn their lines, but I had no such trouble. Harry and Helene were working so well together that everybody else in the cast regarded it as a duty and an honor and a pleasure to support them. I was certainly lucky. Or thought I was. Things were going so well, so hot and heavy, so early in the game that I had to say to Harry and Helene after one love scene, "Hold a little something back for the actual performance, would you please? You'll burn yourselves out." I said that at the fourth or fifth rehearsal, and Lydia Miller, who was playing Blanche, the faded sister, was sitting next to me in the audience. In real life, she's the wife of Vern Miller. Vern owns Miller's hardware store. Vern was Harry's boss. "Lydia," I said to her, "have we got a play or have we got a play?" "Yes," she said, "you've got a play, all right." She made it sound as though I'd committed some kind of crime, done something just terrible. "You should be very proud of yourself." "What do you mean by that?" I said. Before Lydia could answer, Harry yelled at me from the stage, asked if I was through with him, asked if he could go home. I told him he could, and still Marlon Brando. He left, kicking furniture out of his way and slamming doors. Helene was left all alone on the stage, sitting on a couch with the same gaga look she had had after the tryouts. That girl was drained. I turned to Lydia again, and I said, "Well, until now I thought I had every reason to be happy and proud. Is there something going on I don't know about?" "Do you know that girl's in love with Harry?" said Lydia. "In the play," I said. "What play?" said Lydia. "There isn't any play going on now. And look at her up there." She gave a sad cackle. "You aren't directing this play." "Who is?" I said. "Mother Nature, at her worst," said Lydia. "And think what it's going to do to that girl when she discovers what Harry really is." She corrected herself. "What Harry really isn't," she said. I didn't do anything about it, because I didn't figure it was any of my business. I heard Lydia try to do something about it, but she didn't get very far. "You know," Lydia said to Helene one night, "I once played Anne Rutledge, and Harry was Abraham Lincoln." Helene clapped her hands.
"That must have been heaven," she said.
"It was, in a way," said Lydia. "Sometimes I'd get so worked up, I'd love Harry the way I'd love Abraham Lincoln. I'd have to come back to Earth and remind myself that he wasn't ever going to free the slaves, that he was just a clerk in my husband's hardware store."
"He's the most marvelous man I ever met," said Helene.
"Of course, one thing you have to get set for when you're in a play with Harry," said Lydia, "is what happens after the last performance."
"What are you talking about?" said Helene.
"Once the show's over," said Lydia, "whatever you thought Harry was just evaporates into thin air."
"I don't believe it," said Helene.
"I admit it's hard to believe," said Lydia. Then Helene got a little sore.
"Anyway, why tell me about it?" she said. "Even if it is true, what do I care?"
I don't know," said Lydia, backing away. I just thought you might find it interesting."
"Well, I don't," said Helene.
And Lydia slunk away, feeling about as frowsy and unloved as she was supposed to feel in the play. After that, nobody said anything more to Helene to warn her about Harry. not even when word got around that she had told the telephone company that she didn't want to be moved around anymore, that she wanted to stay in North Crawford. So the time finally came to put on the play. We ran it for 3 nights, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and we murdered those audiences. They believed every word that was said on stage, and when the maroon curtain came down, they were ready to go to the Nut House along with Blanche, the faded sister. On Thursday night, the other girls at the telephone company sent Helene a dozen red roses. When Helene and Harry were taking a curtain call together, I passed the roses over the footlights to her. She came forward for them, took one rose from the bouquet to give to Harry. But when she turned to give Harry the rose in front of everybody, Harry was gone. The curtain came down on that extra little scene. That girl offering a rose to nothing and nobody. I went backstage, and I found her still holding that one rose. She'd put the rest of the bouquet aside. There were tears in her eyes.
"What did I do wrong?" she said to me. "Did I insult him some way?"
"No," I said. "He always does that after a performance. The minute it's over, he clears out as fast as he can."
"And tomorrow he'll disappear again?"
"Without even taking off his makeup."
"And Saturday?"
she said.
"He'll stay for the cast party on Saturday, won't he?"
"Harry never goes to parties," I said. "When the curtain comes down on Saturday, that's the last anybody will see of him till he goes to work on Monday."
"How sad," she said.
Helene's performance on Friday night wasn't nearly so good as Thursday's. She seemed to be thinking about other things. She watched Harry take off after curtain call. She didn't say a word. On Saturday, she put on the best performance yet. Ordinarily, it was Harry who set the pace. But on Saturday, Harry had to work to keep up with Helene. When the curtain came down on the final curtain call, Harry wanted to get away, but he couldn't. Helene wouldn't let go his hand. The rest of the cast and the stage crew and a lot of well-wishers from the audience were all standing around Harry and Helene, and Harry was trying to get his hand back.
"Well,"
he said,
"I've got to go."
"Where?" she said.
"Oh," he said, "home. Won't you please take me to the cast party?"
she said. He got very red.
"I'm afraid I'm not much on parties," he said.
All the Marlon Brando in him was gone. He was tongue-tied. He was scared. He was shy. He was everything Harry was famous for, being between plays.
"All right," she said. "I'll let you go. If you'll promise me one thing."
"What's that?" he said, and I thought he would jump out a window if she let go of him then.
"I want you to promise to stay here until I get you your present," she said.
"Present?" he said, getting even more panicky.
"Promise?" she said.
He promised. It was the only way he could get his hand back. And he stood there miserably while Helene went down to the ladies' dressing room for the present. While he waited, a lot of people congratulated him on being such a fine actor. But congratulations never made him happy. He just wanted to get away. Helene came back with the present. It turned out to be a little blue book with a big red ribbon for a place marker.
It was a copy of Romeo and Juliet.
Harry was very embarrassed. It was all he could do to say, "Thank you."
"The marker marks my favorite scene," said Helene.
Said Harry.
"Don't you want to see what my favorite scene is?"
she said. So Harry had to open the book to the red ribbon. Helene got close to him,
and read a line of Juliet's.
"How camest thou hither, tell me, and wherefore?"
she read.
"The orchard walls are high and hard to climb, and the place death, considering who thou art, if any of my kinsmen find thee here."
She pointed to the next line.
"Now, look what Romeo says," she said.
Said Harry.
"Read what Romeo says," said Helene.
Harry cleared his throat. He didn't want to read the line, but he had to.
"With love's light wings did I o'erperch these walls,"
he read out loud in his everyday voice. But then a change came over him.
"For stony limits cannot hold love out," he read,
and he straightened up. And 8 years dropped away from him, and he was brave and gay. "And what love can do that dares love attempt," he read. "Therefore thy kinsmen are no let to me.
If they do see thee, they will murther thee," said Helene,
and she started him walking toward the wings.
"Alack," said Harry, "there lies more peril in thine eye than 20 of their swords."
Helene led him toward the backstage exit.
"Look thou but sweet," said Harry, "and I am proof against their enmity." "I would not for the world they saw thee here," said Helene, and that was the last we heard. The two of them were out the door and gone.
They never did show up at the cast party. 1 week later, they were married. They seem very happy, although they're kind of strange from time to time, depending on which play they're reading to each other at the time. I dropped into the phone company office the other day on account of the billing machine was making dumb mistakes again. I asked her what plays she and Harry had been reading lately.